The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. Hello and welcome to Polling Politics, the election. I'm Joe Twyman from Delta Poll.
I'm freelance journalist Marie Lecomte.
Every week during the campaign, Marie and I round up the key political stories and statistics of the week, and we're also joined by top guests from the world of politics to delve into the polling and public opinion in more detail. Our guest today is Jonathan Bartley. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, top guest. That's very flattering.
Oh, well, then, this is the first of our leaders episodes. We'll be inviting all other leaders of parties to join us between now and next week. Jonathan is the co-leader of the Green Party, a position he's held since 2016, first with Caroline Lucas and now Sean Berry. He was the Green Party's National Work and Pension Spokesperson and the party's parliamentary candidate for Streatham in the 2015 general election. He's a councillor on Lambeth Council and he's running in this election to be the Green Party and Unite to Remain candidate for Dulwich and West Norwood, supported by the Liberal Democrats. He is also the founder and co-director of Ecclesia, the independent think tank looking at the role of religion in public life. Ordinarily, I would crack on straight away, but Marie, I believe there's a question you have to ask.
Yes, Jonathan, we pretended to invite you here basically to talk about politics, but in fact, I would like to bring up the fact that, so we met in Scarborough, the Green Party Spring Conference. A group of us went for drinks.
Oh, hang on.
In
Why did I bottle it on the karaoke, right?
Yes, yes. So your press officer, you and I, decided to do Britney Spears, Oops, I Did It Again, as a trio. Yeah. And then maybe when we're two songs away from us being called, I would like to say you ran away.
So not only did you not do it again, you didn't even do it once.
In the first place.
So what happened?
What happened? I think, which was really rock and roll, I went to bed. I think that was it. But normally, okay, so karaoke is a bit of a tradition at the Green Party conference.
Not at all.
Well, what we tend to do is, I mean, I initiated this tradition. And what we did is like distract all the journalists, usually, and then jump away with a whole bunch of people and run to the nearest karaoke that we booked. And if it's in a little room in a booth, I'm there. I'm right up. I'm first on the mic. But this was like an open bar, wasn't it? It was like anyone was there. Anyone was there with their cameras. And I'm sorry, I had to duck and run. I'm really sorry.
Well,
it was Saturday night in Scarborough. I don't know why
you're complaining, Marie, because you specifically refused to do any karaoke with me. And you actually said that you would kick me in the nuts as you were running out.
Oh, the truth will out.
If I made you do karaoke.
Yes, because, and this is why I will bring this back to Jonathan now, I only ever do karaoke when I do it as a trio of four people, because it means that I can pretend I'm singing, but I'm not actually singing. Whereas I ended up doing it with your wonderful press officer, Georgia, but I had to sing, and she is a very good singer, which she failed to mention beforehand. So our crowd in Scarborough got treated to originally the two of us singing, then me realizing my mistake, and then me holding the mic slightly too far from my mouth. So it looked like I was singing, but actually it was just her beautiful voice.
Is there any video we should be shown?
I really hope there isn't.
If you recall, Marie, we were going to sing Summer Loving from Greece and you flatly refused, despite
Bald
the fact that I had arranged backing singers for you. But anyway, I think we perhaps move on. Although perhaps not fully. You see, as I understand it, Jonathan, you are a member of a band. Is this correct?
I am. I've been playing drums since I was 11 years old.
You've had 10 albums?
With this band, we've just done our 10th album, which is a bit of a self-indulgence, an eco-concept album called Watertown. I was at school with the guitarist and frontman, so we've been playing, God, I won't tell you how many years, but it's
You're
like,
called
over
the
30.
Mustangs.
We're called the Mustangs.
Are you sometimes a bit hoarse?
Jesus Christ.
I think you should
I've been waiting all day to make that joke since I laughed myself silly about it when I thought of it this morning.
That is one of the worst dad jokes I've ever heard.
So you don't sing with the...
I do backing, actually. I do BBs.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you do backing vocals and yet you wouldn't sing with Marie Lecomte. Mm-hmm. I think that says a lot, Marie.
I agree.
About the Green Party's position. That's all I can say. But But more importantly, how's your election going?
It's going really well. I think, you know, we've been waiting for this kind of cut through on the climate emergency for so long. Literally in 2017, just 2 years ago, we had to go around with, we got this big board and made a big green question mark on it and took it around, tried to photobomb interviews and media opportunities, trying to say, let's talk about the climate. Why aren't you talking about it? And now we've had the climate debate. Now it really comes up in every interview that we do. And it's kind of front and center in the election. And, you know, for us, this is something we've been trying to do for decades. And to have it there being talked about is a major, major achievement, you know, not just for the Green Party. Of course, it's down to Extinction Rebellion. It's down to the school strikers, Greta Thunberg. And of course, we've got the COP25 going on right now in Madrid as well, so it's in, you know, it's front and centre in the headlines.
In the polls, the environment is 7th most important issue facing the country when people ask them, 5th most important facing you and your family. But clearly with events such as Extinction Rebellion, it's certainly been front and centre of newspaper and media coverage in a way that it hasn't really been before. So you've noticed that on the doorstep, to use the usual cliche.
I hate using that phrase, but it depends on the constituency, actually. You know, in some areas, not so much. In the area where I'm standing, it's Remain, but also the climate emergency are the big ones. It was the constituency that voted most Remain in the referendum in 2016, so that's not surprising. But the climate emergency does come up. And places like Bristol West, which is a target seat for us, it's coming up. Other areas of the country, I hear less so. So it is patchy.
What's it like being co-leader during a general election campaign? How do you decide who does what? Is it, do you draw lots, toss a coin?
Is there basically a never-ending game of when something comes up that is just like quite boring quite early in the morning, you're like, not me, shotgun, not me?
There is an incentive to get on those, you know, early morning media calls, which we do every morning when we talk about it. But I mean, there are obvious things like, you know, Sian's just on Women's Hour, you know, which is obvious. I tend to take the music questions. So we just did an interview for the Metro on music taste. Some things are more.
You plug your own band in that. Actually, there's a band called the Mustangs. I hear they've released their 10th album just recently.
Yeah. Bonathan Jartley, their drummer, is very good.
I'm trying to plug. I want Mar to have us on. You know, he has those little music sections at the end.
Yeah.
I really want. You know, if you're listening, Andrew, I'm sure.
Which
you
I'm
do.
Sure he is.
But when we did our campaign launch, it meant that I could do the broadcast round in London and Sian and Amelia could go to Bristol for the launch. So that worked really, really well. It means we can be in two places at once, which is really effective. But there are obviously, we play to our strengths as well. So Sian's running in London for London Mayor. So the issues like housing that she's very, very good on, she tends to take those issues. I'll take the different ones that she's not so keen on.
Yeah, I think we talked enough about London Mayor last week. We'll move on from that. And then, of course, you have Caroline Lucas running down in Brighton to provide a sort of third axis for that.
Yeah, and Amelia Womack as well, who incidentally does a very good Kate Bush in karaoke. You should get that.
I can't believe you would bring it back.
Is there such a good thing? I mean, Kate Bush is really difficult.
She does
really
the dance.
Difficult.
She does Wuthering Heights and she spins. It's amazing. It's a sight to behold. Get her in. Get us to talk about it.
that's remarkable. What is your karaoke song of choice, incidentally?
It's usually something like Cigarettes and Alcohol. Something like Oasis.
So good sing along.
Yeah. So I'm
kind
of Manchester is my kind of thing. That was around when I was kind of 18, 19, 20.
Which of the Mustang songs would be best for karaoke?
I See Red and It Gives Me the Blues.
Okay, moving on then.
That well-known hit.
The Green Party are part of the Unite to Remain alliance. And this morning, a member from Extinction Rebellion, or someone claiming to represent Extinction Rebellion, dressed as a bee and superglued himself to the battle bus for the Lib Dems.
Which, again, not entirely clear what that's meant to mean. Because I feel like with direct action specifically, I think you need to have quite a clear idea of what you're trying to convey. And sticky bees, not clear. Anyway, sorry, continue.
So how does the relationship with the Lib Dems work? And how does the relationship with groups like Extinction Rebellion work as well? And where do the two meet other than on Joe Swinson's bus?
I mean, it's Plaid as well. And yes. You know, just I was up doing the spin room when Sian did the debate. On, goodness, I lost track of time. Was it Sunday night?
I don't know what day of the week.
Yeah, same year. Who are you?
I don't know what day
He's
is
the
it.
The person that wouldn't sing with you. We discussed that at length.
I went and sat with Plaid actually, and we were getting on like a house on fire. And just as we were watching Adam, I think Adam did really well in the debate as well as Sian, the leader of Plaid, Adam Price. And at that moment, Caroline texted through to Plaid, and kind of the guy from Plaid showed me the text, and she was saying Adam's doing really well. And there's a really good relationship with Plaid. There's less day to day. communication with the Lib Dems. Obviously, we are very different parties. We wouldn't hit the nuclear button. You know, we wouldn't renew Trident. We wouldn't ever, we were, you know, steadfast around austerity. But where there's that common ground in those constituencies where Remain is a very, very big issue, you know, that's where we're working. End of the day, bottom line is Green voters want to see more Green MPs in the House of Commons. And with the system as it is, you've got to concentrate your vote. And this was a good way of doing it around an issue that we could agree on.
Can you see, with a party like Plaid, a future for this sort of alliance?
I don't think people have appreciated how groundbreaking this is. This hasn't been seen in British politics for decades. And, you know, to let you into, you know, a bit of insight, it took months to put together. We had to go to every local party and we had to talk to every local party. We're a very democratic organisation. Every local party had to have a kind of ballot or a debate or a discussion and make a decision. Some said no. So you then have to kind of go back to Plaid and you rejig the deal and go back to the Lib Dems and rejig the deal. And so it's a kind of three-way conversation, but also with all the parties, and every party has its own structures. So it was quite something to put together. I think that until we get electoral reform, we're going to have to see this kind of thing. Our big disappointment has been continually reaching out to Labour and Labour not wanting to do it. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, we've reached out, we've suggested methods and opportunities, ways of working. It's no secret we stood down unilaterally in about, 25, 30 seats in 2017. I think in two or three of those seats, it made the difference and brought about the hung parliament. And that's a major thing which has been overlooked, but there's been no intent or reciprocation from Labour. So, you know, until Labour give, and of course, until they put electoral reform in their manifesto, they're going to keep lining up more Tory governments in the future.
Do you think there might be a change in that respect further down the line? Let's say if Labour replace their current leader or things change in other ways. Do you think there is light at the end of a possible tunnel when it comes to some sort of relationship with Labour on this?
I mean, who knows? You know, things are changing so rapidly. Clearly, there are, a growing number of Labour MPs that want to back PR. So you've got that, and the local parties who want to as well. But you've seen even over the, you know, the 2030 commitment, conference can pass a motion and then it just doesn't make it into the manifesto. There's a big rowback and there are big interests in the party that don't want to see it. I was vice chair of the Yes to Fair Votes campaign in the AV referendum, and, you know, Labour was split down the middle, even on AV, over it. So, and you know, there were groups on both sides holding a lot of sway and a lot of power. So I really hope so. And I do think it's a question of when, not if. Something's going to have to give. You know, there was the blip in 2017 where there was the big coalescence around the two big parties. But the long-term trend is clear that the vote share of the two big parties in the long term is declining and declining and declining. People want more choice.
But actually, so looking at the relationship between the Greens and Labour over the past few years has been quite interesting, I think, in that in 2015 when Jeremy Corbyn was elected, in kind of early 2016 as well, a lot of stories were about how, you know, Green Party members had, you know, having joined the Greens really because they were disappointed with Labour, left the Greens again to sort of like rejoin mm-hmm. Labour. But then obviously you guys got another spike, I believe, in membership. So what was it, earlier this year or did, late yeah. last year? And I'm guessing part of it were people who were former Labour members who were disillusioned with Jeremy Corbyn. So how, yeah, I guess, you know, that those kind of like membership flows, how have they been going and how?
It's pretty much as you described. You know, you're spot on. I guess you know, the experts can tell me, the experts about polling, but it seems to me that people are less and less voting for the same party every year. They're splitting up their votes between elections, different in locals to Europeans. 2 million votes in the European elections we got, which was, you know, colossal.
Well, it's estimated that this election, half of the people voting will have voted for another party at some stage between 2010 and now, which is an enormous level of political promiscuity that just didn't exist in the past.
I like that phrase, political promiscuity.
Yeah, it describes it well.
I mean, we did some analysis after the 2017 election to work out exactly what happened between 2015 and 2017 with the British election study. And I was staggered by this. But in terms of our 2017 vote share, a third were Green voters from 2015. A third were Labour or Liberal Democrat voters from 2015. But a third were Tory and UKIP voters from 2015. So there was a massive churn going on under, you know, the radar, which no one picked up. You know, so there is a massive, massive shift going on between elections, which doesn't get detected in the simple kind of swings that people see.
I'd love to interview actually people who've gone from UKIP to the Greens about what their motivations are. But that being said, actually, that slightly, like, I'm not going to do a terrible Joe segue, but I think it does bring me kind of to another question I wanted to ask. So how, because we've kind of mentioned the fact that people massively care about the environment now and it's one of the big issues of the election, But to be blunt, you've not sort of seen some kind of, you know, like enormous jump in the polls or anything. Because, you know, because every party has been talking quite a lot about green issues. So how do you feel about that? Because I'm guessing, like, in one way, you are winning because you care massively about the climate crisis. And everyone is finally talking about it now. But on the other hand, because they've kind of co-opted a lot of maybe your kind of like lighter policies, then that's not necessarily transforming into sort of like, you know, electoral sort of like great victory for you guys. So how do you balance that out, I guess?
The reality is it's about, a lot of it's about resources and targeting. And it's been a very kind of slow but constant build for us in terms of local council seats. You know how the Lib Dems did it to get up to whatever they were, 50 before 2010.
It was
back in those days. You know, they built up the council base, they built up the activists around the council base, and then made the bid for parliamentary seats. And it's very, very hard under first past the post to do that. We saw in the European elections that big surge going up from 3 to 7 MEPs, 2 million votes. But then there was that big push, you know, people getting, trying to get people to vote tactically in a proportional election, which is slightly bizarre. But, it, you know, people, I think some people saw through it, but it clearly cost us a seat in the southeast. You know, the tactical voting in that election, the so-called tactical voting, actually was incredibly misguided. We lost, we could have had another Remain seat, you know, for the Remain parties. People hadn't voted tactically, hadn't been kind of pushed to go for the Lib Dems. I wonder if after this election that the kind of push to tactically vote is going to be seen in retrospect quite naively, because the churn between even 2017 and the European elections on the ground is quite significant. And people are looking at the 2017 results rather than looking at what's happened since 2017 in terms of the European elections. I know where I am in Dulwich and West Norwood, you know, in the European elections, Labour came third in what would have been normally a safe Labour seat, with Lib Dems and Greens on 64%. You know, with Lib Dems not standing there. You know, I'd be fascinating to see what the result is in Dulwich and West Norwood. So, you know, the simple idea of swings, a lot of local factors on the ground. I'm not sure the extent you can tell me how much the MRP polling that's come out is reflecting the local factors and the local campaigns on the ground, on the constituency by constituency level.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the problem with MRP, that it can't reflect the hyper-local constituency details. And so it can incorporate something like incumbency, which every constituency will have, but it won't necessarily take account of the fact that a particular MP or a particular candidate running to replace that MP is particularly well known, particularly not well known, that sort of thing. And so lots can still happen. And the results from 2017, though, they were lauded for being accurate, generally speaking. And yes, they got things like Kensington right and they got things like Canterbury right. There were also ones they got wrong on the flip side of that. One thing I'm interested in is we've obviously seen the role of Extinction Rebellion expand as a movement outside politics. Once this election is out of the way, where do you see the Green Party's role then over the next sort of, let's say, 5 years? optimistically assuming five that's years. How long it will be till the next
We're on all underwater by that point. Yeah, exactly. Climate change. Yeah.
Exactly. Do you see a movement more towards that that kind of thing outside party politics? Or focusing consistently on the votes and things?
I was going to be very annoying and tack another question onto this.
Okay, I won't be able to remember all these. I'm very tired. So prompt me if I'm not answering the questions.
We all are. It's fine. It's fine. Again, none
I've
of us know what day
it is.
Half of this. Barely awake. Because I think when you talk to a lot of green activists, and not Green Party, but kind of, I guess, like environmental activists, there is the kind of always debate of, on the one hand, do you try and appeal to people from all over the political spectrum so you can get, you know, as much done as possible? Or do you, because most people who are environmental activists tend to be on the left, or, you know, all busy, do you try and make the case that actually left-wing policies are part of the package deal that will save the planet, which, you know, a lot of these people obviously believe. So I guess, yeah, like how do you fit in that thing between appealing to as many people as possible, but also being a political party and being on the left on a lot of your policies and stuff?
We know where our core base vote is. You can look at it in different ways, but if you're going to be younger, you know, you're more likely to vote Green. But there's, you know, you can look at the values voters, the settlers, the pioneers, prospectors. You know, we are very much kind of down at the bottom of that values voters segment. You know, it's the internationalists. It's the people who are very concerned about the climate emergency, but also very welcoming to refugees and migrants. It's people who are very progressive in their economic views in terms of wealth redistribution. So that's the kind of natural core vote. A lot of people from the movements, I always talk about one of my heroes, who's Tony Benn. When he retired, he said, "I'm leaving the House of Commons to concentrate on politics." And it was his conviction that it's movements that really change, you know, things and shift whole agendas. And we've seen that with Extinction Rebellion, and clearly we benefited from that. There's no doubt about it. The terms left and right I think for a lot of people, clearly we're, you know, you'd put us on the left libertarian section of politics. If you did a kind of left-right axis and then an authoritarian libertarian axis, we'd be down on the left libertarian.
Many of us have done A-level politics.
There you go.
Class is the basis for voting. All else is embellishment and detail. Discuss.
Clearly, then that's the place we inhabit. But when you see it's been masked a bit by the dominance of Brexit in the political kind of discourse. But what's happening over the continent is this green wave coming down from Northwest Europe. And I've just met a few weeks ago with other Green Party leaders over in Brussels, and we were discussing this. And the old kind of left-right standoff is kind of breaking down. And it's you know, often in these countries, you're seeing in Germany, it's a kind of bridges, not walls, open, inclusive to migrants and refugees, climate emergency kind of on the one side, and this populist authoritarian climate denial, very kind of building walls, not bridges kind of mentality. And it's a lot about values and people identifying with one or other party. But clearly, I mean, I don't think it's come across in this election, but in our manifesto, there is a colossal wealth redistribution proposed, you know, that far outstrips Labour, you know, in the Green Party manifesto. And I don't think people have clocked it yet. They've seen our kind of proposals for borrowing on the capital side, but on the revenue side, it's double as well what Labour are proposing.
And do you think that scares some people off, that sort of position, who otherwise would be interested, if you like, in the environmental mm-hmm. side, but are perhaps socially and economically conservative with a small c in other ways?
I don't think it's registered, but it shouldn't scare people, because our proposal for a universal basic income, for example, we're saying is this is part of our Green New Deal. We're going to have to transition. We know we're going to have to transition, and it's going to be a time of monumental change. And so people need to be protected, absolutely need to be protected. And that's why we need that wealth redistribution, to protect those at the bottom, at the sharp end. But also saying this kind of paying homage blindly to GDP without seeing which actually sectors of the economy need to be invested in and which don't is a nonsense way to run the economy. You know, it's not sophisticated, it's not nuanced, and it doesn't really do us any favours. We want to bring the question back to who the economy is for. And of course, the alternative to kind of grow is to say, actually, the economy is three times bigger than it was when I was born. We haven't increased the population three times. We've also had this huge technological revolution, which makes, you know, new things possible. Why are we not actually focusing more on that equalisation, tackling inequality, rather than this endless quest to GDP and the idea that it floats all boats when actually people are drowning?
Would you say that Boris Johnson is an environmentalist?
No.
Next question.
Jeremy Corbyn?
He's got an allotment.
Do you think they're more paying lip service to environmental issues, or do you think they actually believe what they're saying?
No, I think Jeremy believes what he's saying. I do.
So by process of elimination, then, you don't think Boris Johnson is...
No, I don't think Boris Johnson believes what he's saying.
And so you think he's paying lip service to
it? I do think he's paying lip service to it, yeah.
Is it Carrie cares? That's her thing. Like, effectively, I know, which is a weird thing, because she technically doesn't have...
Carrie, his partner, doesn't have a role.
Yes, Carrie Simmons. It is a slightly weird thing to say, but, you know, she's been posting pictures of her, like, endless campaigning, so I think it is fair to say she is playing a role in the kind of, you know, Conservative campaign. But she is the one, famously, I think, who massively cares about this thing. And I can't remember who it was. I think it may have been the Londoner's Diary, actually, that pointed out that when Boris started dating Carrie, he started massively caring about green stuff. And it's like, oh, that's nice. You did your flirting via the medium of policies.
Pretending like when you start a new relationship and you pretend that you like the band that the person's
into.
Yeah,
no, exactly.
Well, it's like the Mustangs, I guess. that would
Everyone pretends they like the Mustangs. No one really likes the Mustangs.
With that difference being there, do you think that a Conservative-led government rather than a Labour-led government would be worse for the environment?
Oh, unquestionably. You just got to look at their record over the last 9 years. Pulling the rug from under the solar industry, making it harder to get renewables in terms of wind. It's, you know, being dragged through the courts three times and losing over air pollution. You know, we saw it when Boris was mayor. He tried to kind of produce this sticking air pollution to the road idea. You know, another one of his ham-fisted ideas that went nowhere. You know, there is no vision, there's no ambition. Even for the 2050 target of carbon neutrality, which is too late, they aren't on course to meet it. Their fourth and fifth carbon budgets under the Paris Agreement being discussed right now in Madrid, you know, they're going to miss them. And they haven't even included aviation or shipping emissions in those figures. It's an absolute disaster. And there's no intent, you know, to address it that I can see. I'm really, really worried. I mean, genuinely worried if we get a Conservative government.
We're joined now for our weekly chat with Matt Shaddick from Ladbrokes Politics. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Joe.
So, what are the big stories in the betting markets this week?
Well, I think the market is easing towards a Tory majority even more than it was before, because the polls haven't in truth moved a lot in the last week after there being a bit of improvement for Labour. And so the current probability, based on the odds that Ladbrokes have at the moment, is around a 65% chance Tories gain majority. That's up a little bit. But there's still a fair chance for hung parliament, right? It's about a 35% chance that we'll get that. And so plenty of people betting both sides.
And let's focus on the number of big names that could potentially lose their seat. Is that something that you've taken a lot of money on?
Yeah, I mean, constituencies where there's a sort of high-profile person at risk have been some of the ones we've taken the most money on. Talked about Dominic Raab last week. Even more money for the Lib Dems to gain that seat in the last few days. So he's up to about a 38% chance of losing. A couple of other people I'd point out on the Tory side. Well, Ian Duncan-Smith in Chingford and Woodford Green. That is getting very, very close to betting there.
I feel like Labour have been throwing everything they have at it. But actually, I think, interestingly, not just since the campaign began, but it's been quite a long time, I think, of just having activists there every weekend, etc.
So if you look at the odds on all the individual seats, Labour aren't favourites in a single seat that they don't already hold. But the one that they're closest to happens to be Chipping Barnet, I think. And then the second one is Chingford and Woodford Green. So this does look like one of the best prospects.
So again, it's from Remain-leaning constituencies?
I guess so, yeah. Seats in London where something like that might happen. And of course, Ian Duncan-Smith famously is a very keen Brexiteer.
So would Theresa Villiers be at risk as well then?
Yeah, I think that's the Chipping Barnet seat.
For our less nerdy listeners.
Those that live within zones 1 and 2 or outside zone 5, imagine.
And one other person of that ilk, I mean, John Redwood in Wokingham. I think there was in a poll in that seat a few weeks ago which showed that being very close. So he's another one on the Tory side. He might be facing a few problems. On the Labour side, there are a few big names who might be in a bit of trouble. I mean, Laura Pidcock, who's currently third favourite to be the next Labour leader.
Not if he gets deselected.
No, but there's a 35% chance, according to our odds, that she's going to lose in Durham North West. And I suppose one really interesting one now is Jo Swinson. Now, a couple of weeks ago, if you'd asked me, I'd have said, looks totally safe. Everyone's betting on her to hold her seat. Things have changed recently, though.
Not least her personal ratings.
Well, that must have a lot to do with it. And initially, people said, well, the SNP aren't really going to be trying very hard here. They'll be diverting their resources to Tory-held seats, which makes more sense. But, yeah, as I say, the last few days have been a bit of money for the SNP. So now a 31% chance that we'll be having a Liberal Democrat leadership contest shortly after the election, I guess.
Yay! My favourite.
And there's been discussion about the weather and how that will interact with turnout. The Sun today had a report saying that 11 inches of snow were predicted next week. I assume that's in a specific area and not just spread over the entire country. What is the betting on turnout?
Well, yes, interesting. So our current line on turnout is almost exactly the same as we got in 2017, 68.5%. You can bet over or under that number. As you said, the weather is a factor, although I think sort of studies of these sorts of things across different countries have shown that it maybe doesn't make much difference unless it's really, really bad. There's also some evidence, I think, from the polls that the public are slightly more motivated to vote in this election than they have been in previous ones, so that would be an indicator they might be higher. And as I think John Curtis pointed out the other day, because of the time of year we're having this election, the electoral register is a bit more up to date than usual. Fewer dead people on there who can't vote anyway, and so that will have the effect of bumping up the number a little bit, even if people aren't actually voting any more often than they would have done otherwise.
And our guest this week is Jonathan Bartley. How are the Greens performing in the betting markets?
Well, there hasn't been that much activity around them because everyone's assuming they will hold on to Brighton Pavilion. I'm sure they will. And in contrast to past elections, there doesn't seem to be much enthusiasm among punters anyway for backing them to win any other seats. Bristol West, bit of money for them there, which has been their big target seat in elections gone by. Maybe the Isle of Wight, it's another seat where the Lib Dems have stood down to give them a shot. But again, that seems like a very unlikely target. I guess it will be interesting to see how Jonathan Bartley does in Dulwich and West Norwood, where, again, the Lib Dems aren't standing to give him a run at that. But it'd be a massive shock if they managed to get anywhere near the Labour vote there.
Matthew, good to see you. Next week, the big one.
Woo!
Now it's time for our big five election questions. Question number one, Jonathan, what will you be doing during the rest of the campaign?
I'll be doing a lot of talking like this.
Talking like this with emphasis.
And then gestures.
Talking like this softly.
Softly and empathetically. And then getting very passionate and loud and then being common sense and quiet. I mean, so much broadcast at the moment, which is great, but it's really exhausting. So I'm going to try and get some sleep. I've been getting 5 hours sleep a night.
It's
not enough. And I'm trying to squeeze in time with my children as well, spend time with them. I will be on election night in... I'm jumping ahead. You said for the rest of the campaign. Yes, so election night doesn't count.
In that case, question two, we'll move on to that. What will you be doing during the election day itself?
I will be probably helping out with the Get Out the Vote operation in my constituency in Dulwich and West Norwood, I think.
And you went to Dulwich College with Nigel Farage?
I think there was 1 year of overlap when I was at the bottom and he was at the top of the school. I don't have any recollection of him. Plausible deniability.
And then election night itself, what will you be doing? That's question three.
I imagine it'll be broadcast media from 10 o'clock, and then I have to get the exact time. I think we're expecting the results to come in about 3 o'clock, so they'll then go over to Brixton, where the count is happening.
And question four, what do you think will happen?
Green landslide.
Well, I mean, I'm looking to you to tell me, give me guidance. I do think we may end up in hung parliament territory again, just looking at the trends. I mean, it's very hard because the polls that have been coming out the last few days just seem to be, you know, there seems to be a tightening, then not a tightening. I think we're going to be surprised by the results. The long-term trend does seem to be towards a system that doesn't deliver strong majority governments any longer. That seems to be the case. I know we were really surprised in 2017. I know everyone's tightened up their polling since then, learned the lessons, hopefully.
Yes, we certainly hope for the continued participation of polling politics as an entity. We really hope so.
Yeah, I think choices seem to be a narrow Tory victory or a hung parliament, and my feeling is maybe it's too optimistic, a hung parliament.
And lastly then, who do you think will be the next Prime Minister after Boris Johnson? We've had a range of interesting answers on this question.
I think it'd be me and Sean.
Would you both live in number 10 together? Or would you...
House share.
Yeah.
House share. I have a house share. I lived in a house share since 2001. That's... I bought a house with a mate in 2001, and we have a couple of people living with us. Then he got married, had kids, bought the house next door. We kind of eat together on a Wednesday night, either in our house or his house. We've done it for years. I'm so at home with a house share. That would be great.
So that came before the co-sharing of the leadership?
Yes, yes.
Oh, right. Is there a causal chain there, do you think?
I'm a believer
sharing
in sharing.
My house.
I do. I'm a huge fan of sharing, and I think sharing is the future.
Sharing is caring.
Sharing is I like
except
that,
when it comes to food, where it's famous that Joey doesn't share food.
Yeah,
exactly. Friends actually got that from me rather than the other way around. So you think it'll be you and Sean? And what about realistically?
How dare you?
I was just going to go for failing that, but no, you just.
How dare you? I just think. Quite often in these events, it's someone that you haven't thought about. It's someone you haven't, has gone under the radar.
Yeah, that's why we asked the question.
Yeah, and it's someone I haven't thought of.
Everything's pointing to Alan Mack once again. And finally then, to return back to the issue of singing.
I was not aware of this.
What percentage, this is a question for you, Jonathan, but MLC, you can chip in as well. What percentage of the British population do you think believes they are an above average singer?
So this is like an I'm a Celeb, Get Me Out of Here question, isn't it? Where they go...
Well, it's a bit, except we're not going to make you eat any...
Are you
going
to give me two options? Or are you just going to...
No.
Well,
you can choose a number, an integer, between 1 and 99. That's your option.
So what percentage of the population think they're a good singer?
Think they're an above average singer.
I'd probably go for around 60.
60% think they're an above-average singer. MLC, what do you think?
I am saying 42.
Well, the answer was 60, sort of, but not for people who thought they were above average. The percentage that think they are below average is 60%. The people that think they're an above average singer is only 11%.
Oh,
wow.
And unusually, this is one of the few areas where women are actually more confident than men. 13% of women think they're an above average singer.
Well, look who did the karaoke. Right?
Only 9% for men.
Can't believe you're joking about this.
So serious.
Yes. So, most people, the majority of people, believe that they are below average by some distance, which I think is interesting, and perhaps cause for karaoke. Next week we will be discussing Christmas carols. Jonathan, your favourite Christmas carol?
It's Fairy Tale in New York. It's got to be.
I don't think that's a Christmas carol.
Sorry, it's a Christmas song.
Did you sing that at church?
Everyone else
you
is
scumbag. You man, you cheap lousy. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Everyone else is doing Hark the Herald, and I'm there with the Pogues.
Drumming. Singing backing vocals.
I thought you said favourite Christmas song. It would be probably something like Away in a Manger, because it doesn't strain the vocal cords too much. And at that point, you're so tired, you just want to kind of get it over with when you've got that midnight service.
Okay, well, tune in next week to find out the nation's favourite. Marie, you've got an entire week to think about that. Or indeed to look up the results.
I don't know
internet.
A single Christmas carol. I'm an immigrant, so yeah.
That's the spirit. Jonathan.
Bah humbug.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us. Jonathan is appearing in pantomime
now in the election.
Oh, no, he isn't. Oh, no, okay. Thank you very much. And thank you to Ladbrokes Politics for sponsoring this week's episode. We will see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.